Today you're going to meet one of the most influential people of my adult life. He's like a big brother to me, and he's the business coach of several eight-figure businesses. He's also been the CEO of startups and a $250 million company. And today he runs RoyaltyExchange.com. So today I'm going to grill him about being lost in the wild, the truth about millennials, his habits of success, and his thoughts on a very interesting story that I just read about former President Barack Obama, Matt's top book recommendations, because there's almost no one I know that reads as many books as Matt, and much, much more. So please meet my friend and business partner, Matt Smith. Matt, good to see you again. So you just returned from an interesting vacation where you and your son purposely got lost in the wild. I don't believe you took breadcrumbs, but you did get a guy who taught Bear Grylls how to survive in the wild. So what on earth did you do all of this for?
Well, he was actually the guy who taught Bear Grylls to make fire.
Oh, okay.
Technically, that's what he did. So Bear Grylls before that, and before he showed him how, forced him to do it, had never done it before.
Right.
Which was more recent than TV would let you believe.
Oh, but, wow.
But anyway, so for the last 5 years, I've been organizing these trips with my children. I have two kids, now 11 and 9. Every other year, I take one of them on spring break, and we call it Epic Spring Break. We didn't actually start off with Epic. We just said spring break, and we wanted to make it really interesting. But
and it's one at a time. So
one at a time.
Yeah, you alternate.
Yeah, so I take one of them each year. So I've done now three of them with my son and two with my daughter. Now my daughter's up for next year. So,
and you've chased tornadoes and caught them?
Yeah, we've chased tornadoes and caught them. We've planted trees in schools in Central America. We've
rappelled.
We've done a lot of rappelling and rock climbing, rappelling through waterfalls, canyoneering, that kind of thing. A lot of walking in the desert.
Yeah.
Literally. And it's been very good. And the whole idea behind these trips is I'm trying to actually expand the way they think about kind of the world and about themselves. And I really think that one of the key things that I try and do for myself is change my paradigms, you know, to find new mental models, new approaches, I guess, to thinking about my life and how I might do better. So that's what I try and do for my kids. And this year with my son, we've done a lot more outdoor stuff, camping, you know, stuff that always pushes his limit physically. And this year we did something that was certainly pushed his limit and mine, frankly, physically. And it was what you would call primitive outdoor survival training. And we hired this guy who was one of America's foremost survivalists. The guy was born 3 centuries too late. I mean, he's a very odd individual, but incredible and remarkable and generous and loving and truly skilled guy. So he was with us, and we did not bring breadcrumbs. In fact, we had no food at all, which I wasn't quite sure. I knew it was going to be there was going to be something around food, like a challenge around food, but I didn't understand that neither they nor I were bringing any food at all.
Interesting. All right. So you actually went, of all places, Catalina Island.
Yeah.
And so as soon as you hear that, we're like, oh, wait a minute. There's like resorts there and stuff, but it's a large enough island for you guys to get lost on.
Yeah. We weren't really lost exactly, but we were definitely isolated. So the basic idea, when I heard Catalina Island, I had never been there. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm definitely thinking resorts. I thought it was, I don't know. I figured there must be a St. Regis there, right? I don't think there is, but there are resorts. We didn't see any of them though. And we started off, we flew in on by helicopter from Long Beach, and which I got to see Van the day before, okay. Which is great. And we landed by two harbors. And from there, we had a 12-mile hike, it was beautiful. I mean, it was really beautiful there right now. It's unusually green there.
Okay.
Because they've had so much rain this year. So it was really gorgeous. And we hiked for 12 miles to get to a canyon that was, we didn't see anyone else in this area the entire time we were there. And, it was a terrible campsite. In fact, it was a bad choice, but it worked out. Okay. It was a good adventure for us.
Right. And then, so your son was challenged over the course of the time, but you felt like he grew and had a really great experience.
Definitely. I mean, so there's several good things about this. And I think that, this is probably the only thing I could say that I've done as a parent that I'm actually really proud of. Because I think basically as a parent, you're trying not to screw up so bad. You know, you're just trying to keep it together. So, but I'm really proud of these because, and they've gotten better and they've evolved. But what the one-on-one time that I get with them is the foundation of my relationship with them. This one-on-one time that occurs in these events, because there are no distractions. There is no technology. I mean, I didn't have a phone or computer. My watch was off for the entire time. I mean, I had that in my bag. We were supposed to be living in a primitive way, so we didn't have any of that anyway. We weren't supposed to have any of it. But we had lots, we had hours and hours of time to talk. And he asked me about adult stuff. I told him stories, about just, our family history, my history a little bit more, things he would never know probably if we didn't have this time to talk. And he, a kid who's not normally very talkative, was just rambling on about stuff. And it was
awesome. You had nothing else to do.
Yeah. I mean, well, especially when it's just he and I, and we're hiking, because we left one of the guides a couple miles back, and it was just he and I in the middle of nowhere, hours and hours to talk. So it was great for that. But also, I think one of the most interesting things, what I wanted for this trip for Max is I wanted him to break. I wanted him to see that through the challenges that we were going to have, that it would be okay. Even though there would be a point in it where he felt like we would definitely not be okay.
Got it.
So we definitely got that in this trip.
And what was that, like second night or something?
Yeah, it was just the second night. And it was. I mean, we didn't have food. So you got to count. That's a factor. And a kid who's not really gone, I mean, he's missed a meal in his life, but probably not two in a row.
Right. While hiking 9 miles a day or 12 miles.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, and I fasted plenty, but I haven't, I've never done it where I'm expecting or demanding that much of myself physically. So yeah, that night he did break. He was like, he just wanted to get out of there. And I actually knew that I didn't have the physical stamina to leave then. Like, even if we wanted to, I wouldn't have been able to, I mean, literally wouldn't have been able to make it.
Got it.
So I'm like, I don't think I can. I mean, maybe tomorrow morning. He's like, well, I can do it. I'm like, well, would you go without me? He's like, no. I'm like, okay, I can see you're in that place right now. You're in that moment. We talked about it, you're having that moment, and it's going to be okay. And then within minutes, he crashed. He was deep, dead sleep.
Now, I know you haven't been back for that long, but what do you expect in terms of short-term and maybe even long-term changes in the perspective on things? Or is it all kind of go away until the next break?
Well, I think the best you can hope for is that you're planting seeds.
Got it.
I think there are some times there are things better than that come out of it, but that certainly comes out of it. He's been weirdly affectionate to me since we got back. I mean, it's really nice. I mean, I'm keeping coming. He's always 30. I'll still take it. But he's been weirdly affectionate. Like even this morning, I mean, it's just a little bit strange, but it's good. I love it. I think that he was talking about how he felt stronger, because of he felt stronger from the whole thing. So I don't know how long that perspective will last. Certainly his idea of what hunger is will be forever changed, because he will remember among other things, he ate a lizard.
And rattlesnake.
We both ate rattlesnake, which isn't too bad, actually. Funny fact, you can actually eat rattlesnake raw, because basically no, like salmonella and stuff like that it doesn't work. It doesn't exist in rattlesnakes and poison snakes.
Got it.
I never would have thought that.
Well, when we were calling this an epic adventure, all I could think of was like those epic bars. And then I saw you guys eating the rattlesnake and I thought, oh, well, maybe those come up with a new flavor of epic rattlesnake bars.
Yeah. I think the epic bars are better.
Okay.
Yeah, they really are. But at that point, I mean, it tasted pretty good to us. So I think that, but his idea of hunger. So when he says he's hungry, I'll be able to say, okay, you're hungry. But are you hungry? No, Dad, I'm not.
Are you hungry enough to eat some rattlesnake?
Right. Exactly.
Very good.
So, yeah. Who knows what'll come long term?
Yeah, and you know what? One of the best things there is that, you spent 4 days with absolutely no electronics and no distractions. And most people, I mean, if you counted up the minutes in an entire year, would a parent get, 4 days worth of that amount of time? No. So it was extremely valuable that way, I'm sure.
I think that if you have more than one kid, it's really hard to have one-on-one time with them, because it's almost like they always go in pairs or threes or whatever. And then they affect each other. So they're not really with you. They're more with each other when you take all of your kids. And then the other thing is that it's actually very odd for people to travel. Like, say, I'm going to take I'm going to take the kid on spring break and you're not invited. Like that idea to people seems so foreign. I think, and I understand it because you don't get much family, good family time either. But I think that oftentimes that individual time that both parents have with kids is sacrificed for group family time, which ends up being fairly meaningless because of the fact that you have to target whatever activity you're doing as a family in such a way that it's appropriate for every member of the family.
Right.
So if I try to do everything, if I try to do stuff with Max and Bella together, like they wouldn't even be able, I would have to, you know, reduce it to the lowest common denominator.
It's compromise.
Yeah, exactly. So rather than trying to find something that's going to take Max along his edge, or last year taking Bella to teach English in a Nicaraguan classroom, like which was really put her out of her comfort zone in a huge way, would have been, Max wouldn't have gotten anything out of that.
Right.
But for her, it was really meaningful, especially with what I thought she needed to see then. She needed to see the poverty and how people are still can be loving and happy and have nothing. And all those things that came from that trip was designed for her.
Got it.
Are you excited about planning next year already? I mean, you got to step up every year. That's the hard thing.
That is actually the hardest thing. And so and this year, I was actually worried. I was worried about this year for a lot of reasons, but I knew I was going to, it was suffering was going to be involved. So I was worried about it for that, for me. I don't like suffering if I can avoid it. But also because the last time I did it with Max was so crazy good. I mean, that's where like Reed Timmer, who is the, was on the show that was on Discovery Channel called Storm Chasers.
Right.
And Max was a huge fan of him. And I remember there was a couple of years, well, about a year period where I kept hearing, and I am divorced, so I kept hearing him talk about this Reed guy. And I'm thinking, you know, okay. So I finally asked him, like, so what's, who is this Reed guy? I'm thinking it's somebody my ex is dating. And he's like, no, Dad, it's Reed Timmer. Okay. You know, from Discovery Channel, from Storm Chasers. I'm like, oh, okay. So it's a guy on a TV show. Oh, okay. So anyway, he got really into tornadoes and weather and still is. And, we organized as part of that, our spring break that we did, the last time with him, we went storm chasing with Reed, who is, I think, you know, my experience with him is certainly that he's the best storm chaser in the world. I mean, he got us a tornado. We got to see a tornado. We were within 100 meters of one. It was extraordinary. So I was like, there's no way that I can, I mean, my son met one of his heroes.
Yeah.
And we saw a tornado, which was like awesome and terrifying at the same time. I don't think I could top that. So I was really worried about his expectations not being so high. But he got a lot out of this one. He really did. And didn't feel like, he certainly felt like it was still epic. So it still counts.
But good.
Next year, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the plan is.
Awesome. I'll
figure it out.
All right. So now that you're back to civilization, tell us about your new business that you're running.
The business I'm running now is a business called Royalty Exchange. And what we do is we help artists and creatives who own royalty-generating intellectual property. We help them monetize those. So in the simple way of explaining it, actually, we help typically songwriters who have written songs that generate royalty income. We help them essentially raise capital by selling a piece of that to investors. So if you think about like when Mark Zuckerberg took Facebook public, he wasn't selling out or anything. He went to the public markets, made some of the company available to investors. He still retained control of it. But he allowed that, you know, he used that money to reinvest in the business. And that Facebook is three times bigger than it was when it went public. And he's four times wealthier than he was when it went public. And we essentially allow artists to do the same thing. So if you already have royalty income, we have investors who are eager to invest in that royalty income and, you know, to own a piece of it for just because the consistent income that comes from these assets. And it gives artists great opportunities, and it's great for investors in this environment where you can't get interest or yield anywhere. So that's what the business really is. And we bought it in late 2015, relaunched it in February of 2016. And
because the people you bought it from, they had a good idea but didn't make it work right?
Yeah. I mean, they made it, you know, nothing bad about them. They made all of the same entrepreneurial mistakes I've made. It was just their first time, first business. So they made them on that business. And so we bought it from them. It was a distressed asset is the way I would describe it. And we didn't bring in any of the staff or anything. And we relaunched it in February. So, and it's going great. I mean, we've done more. We did more in 5 months than it did in the prior 4 years of existence. So it's on the right track.
Every time I try and explain this business to people, I always say, You know that Hugh Grant movie about a boy where he had the father who wrote the Christmas song and he, you know, he's just living the life of luxury because of royalties? It's kind of related to that. So that's my starting off point when I do that. So what's like been the coolest auction that you guys have had? Because you auction off these royalties.
Yeah. Well, we've had some big name artists, but usually it's not the artist that's selling. It's usually one of the songwriters that's associated with it.
We have a from Patrick Beith, my friend. We have a wow, Matt Smith live on camera. Yes, it's yes. Like the elusive Matt Smith. We've caught him. We've got him here. So we do have a couple of questions we'll get to in a second, but Matt, carry on there.
So we have some big name artists, assets from big name artists, but it's actually the songwriters often who are selling it, not the artists themselves. So we, for instance, we've sold some Kanye songs, which a lot of people like Kanye. So that's pretty cool. And they're usually, they're pretty small. I mean, the income from them, so the assets aren't terribly expensive. My favorite was a Barry White song that we did. I mean, I like it because it's a great asset. It's been earning, it's his second most famous song, and it's been earning income for decades, and it's very consistent. So as far as from an investor perspective, I'd like to own it. I mean, it's a classic. Barry White is going to continue on for another, it's going to earn income for another 20 years.
Got it.
And it's just a cool trophy asset. I think if you could own one, that'd be a good one to own. And it was actually one of the songwriters on that song. He passed away, and it was his son. And he just sold just a portion of it,
okay,
to kind of as a financial strategy, essentially he basically used the proceeds for it to buy another source of guaranteed income, essentially hedging against the music. A very sophisticated guy, actually, making a really smart financial decision, and he got a great multiple for the asset, and was still able to retain all of the rest of the rights, and it's great. So that's what the business is, and it's fun when we have more than half of the artists whose assets we've sold are referred or are people who come back to sell more later. So most of our customers, are very excited to do it again. I mean, it really works for artists for sure.
And it's very complex, the whole situation, in that, you know, there's what, 6 or 7 people who have royalties on a song?
And it can get messy. I mean, the music business in general, the entertainment business actually in general, the music business specifically is not known for its transparency, which is part of the problem with all of these things. But in addition to that, there are different copyrights associated with the song. So like if you write it, if you're a songwriter, you have a, what's called a composition copyright. So just basically the notes on a page, essentially, the lyrics on a page, you own that. Now, when those are used then in a sound recording, you earn a royalty.
Okay.
Okay. Every time it's played. And when you're, but there's also a sound recording copyright, which is usually owned by the label.
Oh, okay.
So and then they get paid for that. They get paid every time that's played. So, how exactly people get paid depends upon where it's played, and it's very complex.
Luckily. Especially now with streaming and all that sort of stuff.
Ultimately, it's going to make it much easier and totally transparent. The labels are big holdouts, I think, and still in the transparency side of things, although they've really improved a lot. But technology is making it a lot easier to keep track of stuff, and it's going to get better over time.
Well, it's a very interesting and exciting business. And now I want to get into one of our favorite topics that you and I talk about a lot, which is the millennial age bracket, because you run a company which has a lot of employees who are millennials. So what is your take on this this generation? Because, hey, everyone loves a good generalization.
Yes. Why not?
Generalize, tens of millions of people?
Well, I think that my view on it has evolved, where at first all of the challenges with that generation probably were forefront in my mind. And now I think I have a different perspective on it. I think it's a deeper understanding. Mm-hmm. And at our Toys for Tots event, one of the things I talked about was that they value things that boomers especially do not. And I think even Xers like us, Xers, not you, you don't value these things. You know what my analogy is, and you have no value for these things. You don't value them at all. But there was a time where for boomers, if their job was going well enough that they could go buy a brand new Lexus or a Mercedes, that was a social signal to their peers, to their spouse, to everybody essentially, that they were doing well, that they were contributing. I mean, there was prestige associated with it. And it wasn't petty. And I think millennials sometimes look at that and they go, that's silly and petty. But it was a signal that was used to help your neighbors understand that you were doing well and doing okay and doing, you know, creating value. Now, millennials look at that and they think that that's absurd. On the other side, boomers look at what millennials do and think it's absurd. So millennials value things that they don't value the car, but they do value being able to tell their friends that they're working for an organization that is doing something worth doing. You know, that is something that's really important to them. That's a social signal, being able to working for an organization that actually is doing work that's important from their perspective. And, you know, that is, and they're creating value that way. And they also value other things, like they value a place where they can have their opinions heard, where they're encouraged to express themselves and so forth. So, which, you know, boomers did not value that. They thought that was a highly risky and not really that important anyway, you know. So I think the values, understanding a little bit more, and I have a lot to learn, of course, and this and everything. But I think understanding the perspective that they have and, having now that I understand more of it, I have a greater appreciation for it because I think it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think a lot of that is more valuable, in fact, than certainly, you know, I just bought a Tesla Model X.
Oh, you did?
I did. Yeah. I didn't get it yet, but I just bought one. So that's a social signal.
Well, that might be, Actually, that might be a combination though. Like a millennial might be a little bit more into that.
Cause I think it's green, but I just want the autopilot. That's all I care about.
So, you know, thinking in terms of that, I mean, everyone's always going to, or at least wisely would say, you know, no generation is going to be the same and there's always going to be differences and stuff like that. But do you feel like there's more differences between the boomer generation, millennial generation than maybe the generation that came before boomers and us?
I don't know. I mean, I think that I've seen some good arguments that the boomers destroyed the world. I know that sounds crazy, but listen, if you look at I'm going to make boomers upset here. I love boomers. I like people in general. So like, understand, I'm just offering a perspective here. Okay. But, this country is, trillions and trillions. And if you look at unfunded liabilities, like $120 trillion in debt, a debt that is absolutely unpayable. And that debt is essentially there for the boomers at the cost of every other group that will ever come again in America. And there's a sense among some that boomers have basically, have basically taken advantage of all of the great industrial capability that the United States built after World War II, all of the goodwill that we had, the fact that we controlled the money supply and, you know, that we had the world reserve currency and, you know, ran up enormous amounts of debt. And essentially to focus on themselves. And so where boomers think that millennials are so narcissistic, you know, and you might see because they're taking selfies and they're posting their travel on Facebook, they look at them as so narcissistic. The actual behavior of the boomers was far more narcissistic than what we've seen. And the millennials haven't had a chance to screw it all up yet. Doesn't mean, or neither of the Xers yet, you know? So not to say we would do a better job, but the boomers have messed stuff up. I mean, they were in control for a long time and they failed to meet the challenge, I think you say.
Right. And it's probably, if anybody else was in that situation, they probably would have done the same sort of thing because it was, here's the American dream. You better get out there and chase it. And, you know, it's not like any individual boomer was out there you know, stealing or anything. It was just, you know, we were voting for this and that. And because everyone's aspiring for this thing.
Yeah, I'm really talking about the leadership of the country at that time. I mean, there was a lot of faith, I think, that people had and still has, by the way. We still have these boomers running things. So I think it's those folks that really mess it up, not, you know, the people who are working hard, building families, you know, doing like, it's not them.
Right. So you have had the opportunity to manage both boomers and millennials. And what's the difference in working with them?
Honestly, the only real difference is the motivation based upon the phase of life they're in. And I don't think that's a generational thing. I mean, I think, you know, boomers were in their 20s, like their attitude toward work and, you know, working hard, staying later, all that stuff was like they were totally fine with it. I find that the millennials that work for Royalty Exchange have they do that all the time. They have no, it's not like they're, you know, prioritizing their lifestyle or anything like that to any extent other, you know, beyond what any other generation would.
Just like the... that age group when they were, you know, we both read the Elon Musk book recently, so we're going to refer to it quite a bit. But I mean, those people of all age groups were working late, and right. they were a lot of young people too.
Right, exactly. Now, the thing is that when people, though, when you start to have kids, then you're often, and boomers have kids that are, you know, in their teens or older. Mm-hmm. So if they're still at home, like they're very involved with the kids, and they're very involved with the, you know, the soccer and all that stuff. And so, or whatever people, whatever the kids are doing. And I think that, you know, their priorities are different a little bit. Like they aren't necessarily trying to, when you're young, when you're in your 20s, you're not thinking about downside, you know, you're not thinking about risk. And I think, but if you're not thinking about risk when you're in your 50s, like there's something wrong with you. So it just makes sense. I really think it is much more about the age group that you're in at the time and the motivations you have at that time than any specific generational issue.
So when you were younger in the 90s, you were bouncing around America, learning from mentors, and then eventually, you know, did some management and stuff like that. So what would you be doing if you were a millennial-aged person today? Where, you know, what would you be excited about, and where would you go and learn, and what would you try to be involved in these days?
Well, I think a lot of what I did translates well to now, in that I was always very, very interested in technology. I was never, I'm not an engineer. I can't code anything to save my life. I mean, I could copy and paste some HTML from time to time if I had to, I guess, but I wouldn't trust myself to do that anymore. I can't do anything technology-wise, but I love technology and what you can do with it or what's done with it. So I'm definitely an early adopter of consumer technology for sure. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that I don't know where that would take me today. Where my guess is it would have taken me much more into the doing of technology, into building technology, versus simply being a consumer of it, because just even access to information about technology is totally different now than it was in the early mid 90s.
So right? You'd be in San Francisco drinking Soylent all day and working.
I don't know. Maybe. Certainly, I would go where the opportunity was, but the opportunity is less about necessarily a geographic region and much more about the people that you have the opportunity to go and work with. Mm-hmm. You know, the people that can change your perspectives. And I think that that's what I would encourage millennials to do now, is to find people. I mean, I really believe in the apprenticeship model, because I think that it's very hard to succeed in a world of knowledge work if you don't have examples of people that thrive in that knowledge work around you. So finding ways to associate yourself with those folks is a great advantage to invest in your future. So I think the difference as a millennial, I think that I would prioritize my personal preferences higher. I mean, millennials do make what they want a high priority. And I think for me, you know, much, I'm not a masochist in that, but I'm certainly was willing to self-sacrifice anything, you know, anything. It didn't really matter to me. I wanted to grow and I wanted to move. I wanted to move forward. And I was willing to do whatever I had to do that.
Like living in Buffalo in the wintertime.
Like living in Buffalo in the wintertime. Yeah, that sucks. I interviewed a guy yesterday, and who's a millennial, and he's a very talented guy. I shouldn't say anything else about it in case he's listening. So, but I will say that he's been offered other positions, which he is qualified for outside of Colorado, including a great one with Amazon, by the way, wow. a great job with Amazon. And he declined because he was not willing to leave Colorado. Like for me at his age, that would be crazy. What's wrong with you? Mm-hmm. You know? But I think there's something about the millennials and going all my way where my preferences don't matter, and also going the way where your preferences are top priority, is both of those are equally wrong, I think. But I think that a lot of millennials have found that balance. And I think that that's the right, a better way to live.
Very nice. Very nice. So one of the things that we do and we're really proud of and we're really excited about is the blacksmith camp that we do. This is our eighth year doing it. We go to the middle of nowhere, Lithuania. A long story, but it's really fantastic. So first year that I went was 2010, and we'll be going back there again in a couple months. And at the camp, we have 50 students or so. So I think maybe up to 60 students now. from all over the world, usually at 35 different countries. So these kids are doing what you said, which is going where the opportunity is, and they are expanding their horizons, and they're meeting other people from all around the world, which is probably one of the biggest differences between this generation and every other generation, is the ability to have friends halfway around the world that you've never met before. So tell us about what you like the most about the camp, because what the kids do is they come and they learn from Matt and myself and one of our friends, Simon Black, and also from another person here involved in ETR, Jeff Schneider. And we love to teach these kids about entrepreneurship and economics and all that great stuff. So tell us about your experiences with the camp.
Well, the best part about it is definitely the kids, and to call them kids is a slight in a way, because these they're not children at all. They're just, we're just getting old.
Right.
So they're, I mean, the average age last year was like 28 or something.
It was close to 30. So okay. Yeah, I mean, it has gotten a little bit older each year. But I mean, what these kids have accomplished.
Yeah, it's really incredible. Impressive. It's not just that they're coming to this event where they have access to each other and access, if I could say so a little arrogantly, access to us.
Yeah.
It's what they did in advance of that to even get there, because there's a rigorous application process. There's not a lot of slots left. Mm-hmm. It truly is scarce. And we get lots of applications that Simon is reviewing. You know, he reviews all of them. They're all video applications.
And he gets over 500 of them. And so it's hours and hours of video.
He spends months doing it, going through them all. And if you haven't done something interesting, if you aren't actually taking, if you're waiting around for your ship to come in, you won't be there. These people, not to say that what these people are doing, the businesses that they started or the organizations they're involved with, that's what they're going to be doing 5 years from now. In most cases, I don't think that's the case. But what they are doing is they're doing something, and they're growing, and they're creating value in the world. And those being surrounded by the great energy of young, growth-oriented people who are out there doing stuff, smart people who have great ideas and, you know, truly want to grow, is like, it's reinvigorating.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, kids come to the camp. What are some success stories, or what are some kids that you've stayed in touch with that you're just really proud of?
Well, I'm very hard to stay in touch with, so that's my fault in a big way. But I mean, from last year, there are several that I have kept in touch with that I, you know, like very much, and that I'm very interested in them all succeeding. I'm not good at keeping in touch. If you want to keep in touch with me, you have to work very hard, and it's okay. Like, it'll be appreciated on my end, but you do have to work.
It's true. I have a hard time. I don't, sometimes.
Yeah. I don't mean it that way. It's my own issue. So, I mean, like I really like, Nate from last year was really great. What he's been doing with his Amazon business is tremendous. And the amount he's grown has been really cool to watch. The problem with naming somebody is I'm not going to name some people, and then they're going to think that I'm not impressed by them. But I'm impressed by all the people that I met at Blacksmith this year.
Well, sure. I'll cut you off, because we are, you know, one of the great things about Nate, and we'll pump Nate's tires again, is that Nate always asks questions. And so he has asked so many questions that we've turned into interviews. And so to give you guys credit who are watching, we're also getting questions here. So Matt, a question from Trey Anderson. Trey, thank you for asking your question. What is the biggest lesson that you've learned working with Agora, and where you were a CEO at Stansberry, and especially Porter and his organization?
The biggest thing I learned.
I mean, Porter is a force of nature. Yeah. I mean, that you spend 30 seconds around, that's a huge lesson.
Yeah. I mean, Porter is a remarkable man, and he is an important friend of mine. And I was honored that he asked me to run his business. And I'm really, was humbling for me in many ways. My biggest fear when I started there was that I would break his baby, because it was a great business before I got there. I believe it's better today than it's ever been, but it was already great. And I think that Porter's ability to attract really smart, hungry people to his organization, I think is one of his best attributes, and I think it's made the organization really flourish. So I think that his, the biggest thing I learned there had to do with finance. I learned a lot about finance, and it's hard to not be around people who are like Porter and all of his analysts and not learn a ton about finance. So I think if I'm being honest, I guess the biggest thing I got was all on the financial side of it. I mean, Porter is a remarkable thinker about these ideas. He brings a lot of innovation to the thinking around them. And he also works to sell those ideas, which makes it easy for people like me to understand. Got so from the finance side, I think it was probably the biggest thing. I think that I was exposed to remarkably good writing there. And so I can't say it necessarily made me a better writer because I'm not really a writer, but what it did, it helped me recognize real skill in the craft of writing, which also Porter and his team are extremely good at that too. So those are two skills that I were sort of unexpected that I would benefit from that I got out of working there.
Well, I will say your writing is excellent. You wrote a report on the trip that we're going to share some of those snippets with our readers. So your writing has definitely come a long way. And I will say that Porter is one of my dream guests for the show because you just, you know, just wind Porter up and you let him go. And I can just sit here.
He's amazing.
He is so entertaining. And I guess there's some parallels with Elon Musk in that the attraction of great people into a company, is that something can be replicated by anybody in any way?
I don't think so. I think I'd only met one other person I would describe as a force of nature before. And I know you often refer to Joel that way too.
Oh yeah. Joel Merriam for sure.
But there's only one other person that I met and he was evil. But he still had all that same, you know, personal charisma and dynamism that created a reality distortion field like Jobs is associated with and really drew people to him. I've met so few people like this that from the moment I met Porter, and Porter sometimes rubs people the wrong way because he's just so
bombastic.
He's big. I mean, he's a big guy, but he's also just, his ideas are big and he's
a little opinionated.
He's brash about them sometimes, but but if you get to know him, he's one of the most thoughtful, generous people I have ever known.
He really is a sweetheart.
Yeah. So he treats his employees really, really well.
They get
paid really well there and they get taken care of and he prioritizes them it's important to him that the incentives are in alignment and people want, they really want to work there, you know?
One of the things that I liked is that you start a lot of people, or maybe not everybody, but a lot of people start off in customer service and have great opportunities to grow there into copywriters and into other positions. So talk about the importance of that and why, you know, if there's business owners listening, why they should consider that if that's an opportunity.
Yeah, well, I think that there are other organizations. Doesn't Zappos do something like that everyone's got to answer phones for the first 2 weeks?
Something like that, yeah.
I think that there's great benefit to being closer to customers. And I think that if you don't work in a role and that's a reasonably large organization. I mean, it's a small business still, but it's much larger than most of the entrepreneurs that we deal with, entrepreneurial ventures. If you start off in like the copywriting group and you have no exposure to the customer, you're making your job harder if you don't really know them. If you start off in, you know, if you're in marketing.
I'm trying not to make a wisecrack about like Hillary Clinton knowing voters or something here.
Exactly. You know? Yeah, exactly. So, but that's true. I mean, like Hillary was selling and, you know, our copywriters are selling and trying to get people to, to follow us, buying a security that's recommended requires salesmanship. I mean, all that. And of course, selling the newsletters themselves requires salesmanship. But if you don't understand the perspective that your customers bring to the table, you're really missing out. And here's like, and a lot of people are looking at, well, yeah, but customer service, like that seems like that's a big waste. Well, Porter personally gets all of the replies from customers when they reply to emails that get sent. He gets them and he reads them.
Wow.
So they're on, there's a 20% chance that right now he's actually reading a customer email. I mean, because he does it so often in spare time, he'll just be flipping through his phone and looking at them. So, but staying in touch with the customer allows him to be as good as he is at what he does. So I think it's really good for an organization to try and move people closer to the front line, closer to customers, at least for context. I think that's important. For the organization and in knowledge work, I think one of the things is there's not great training out there for a lot of the jobs that have to be done in an organization like any Agora business or ETR or others. So how do you train people to succeed there? And I think the best way is something that's like an apprenticeship model. I really believe that that works. And if you go and join the copywriting group at Stansberry, you're going to get feedback from the copywriting team, and over time you'll grow and you have the potential to become a remarkably highly paid copywriter. Because you'll develop the skills over time, but you're not expected, no one expects you to show up on day one and necessarily, you know, blow the doors off. We understand it's a process. And so we invest in developing people. As long as they come in with the right attitude and they're willing to do the work, you know, they're willing to put the words on the page, they're taking enough stabs at it, then, you know, then there's a path for them. So, you know, and Mike Palmer, who leads that group and who's one of the best copywriters alive, makes it a priority to develop people. I mean, he likes bringing people in who he sees potential in and have their, you know, their heart and head in the right place. He thinks he can make them successful. And, you know, just by being around that team and doing the work that's there, they have a chance to thrive. And I think that a lot of times coming into customer service, if you demonstrate to your, you know, to one of our friends' son wanted to be a copywriter for Stansberry, yeah, because there's a big economic opportunity there. Didn't seem like he was ready for that with his head yet. I mean, not in terms of he couldn't have the capability of it, but he seemed a little, he was a millennial. His approach was a little arrogant about it. And so we said, if you'll come and you'll work in customer service for 6 months, let's say, then, you know, we will consider bringing you in as a copywriter. He went there, was there for probably 3 or 4 months, and he was great attitude, hardworking, you know, did all the extra work and started to pick up ideas from Mike Palmer about books he should read and things like that, that he was moved over into copywriting well before that 6 month number. Because once he had with a foot in the door, he took advantage of it. He really leveraged it.
Awesome. So, you know, we have actually mentioned Agora and Stansberry and ETR, and we are actually all under this umbrella. So I just want to give a quick description, then we're going to go on to a question related to this. So Agora was a company started by Bill Bonner. Bill Bonner is one of my favorite writers. He's writing every day. He could be well retired. He started many, many projects. But, you know, Bill Bonner started the company back in the 1980s, and they were financial newsletters. Was the first one International Living? Okay, so International Living is another one of the Agora companies, really about living around the world for boomers, not millennials. And then they started a series of financial newsletters, and that's where Mark Ford came in. So Bill Bonner hired Mark Ford to come in and be a consultant to Agora. And then Mark Ford, after growing many of these companies, including the Oxford Club is another one, and then Porter came along in the 90s and started his company under Agora with everybody's partners here. And then Mark Ford started ETR, Early to Rise, in either 1999 or 2000 or 2001. I can never know exactly what the date is. But Mark started Early to Rise because he started writing these memos to employees of Agora about, you know, here's why you need to come to work early and here's how to be successful. And so he started doing this and he put these on the internet in 2000-ish. And I found it around 2001 or 2002, probably around when you found it. So really Agora is up here and then all these other companies are satellite companies. And then Matt and I bought part of Early to Rise from Agora, but we are still in partnership with them. And we bought it from a guy named Mark Ford, who wrote his books under the name Michael Masterson to make it all as clear as mud. So because,
we'll have an org chart.
Right. We do need this completely, you know, drawn up with maybe some pie charts too. But, you know, Mark actually wrote all his articles for ETR under Michael Masterson. And then he wrote a bunch of books. And one of them was Ready, Fire, Aim. And was Ready, Fire, Aim subtitle From Zero to 100 Million?
I think so.
Okay, yeah. So David Wolf was asking, are you guys associated with the book Zero to 100 Million? And
no,
I can't remember if that's the exact subtitle of it, but Ready, Fire, Aim is the book written by Michael Masterson. Well, that's the pen name of Mark Ford. And that was Mark's best-selling book. And that is the book that I recommend to every business owner. I mean, Mark's advice in that book has made people millions and millions of dollars, because it goes through four phases, right? From zero to $1 million, from one to 10 million, from 10 to 50?
I think so.
And then from 50 and beyond. And it shows you how there's different stages, different focuses of each level that you need to be spending your time and energy on. And most importantly for people listening to this who are probably at that lower level is finding what Mark called your optimal selling strategy, is figuring out the best way to sell. And Mark is a great salesperson, and he emphasizes that 80% of your time should be spent on sales when you are getting a business going. Whereas most people do the opposite. They'll, you know, because sales is tough. Sales is tough, especially if it's face-to-face or on the phone. You get rejected, and a lot of people want to avoid that. So they do the busy work, building websites, filming videos, all that type of stuff that doesn't necessarily lead
to sales.
That we're
doing right now.
Right, right, exactly. So David, I believe we are, if that is the correct subtitle of the book.
Yeah, I think so. But the other thing, you know, when Mark is talking about sales, he's really talking about revenue driving, which includes marketing. And for Mark, he was at one point one of the very best marketers on earth, and probably around the 98 to 2002 level. And I think that the internet, once that, well, that became a more dominant force, and he was probably retiring or trying to step back in for the fourth time or seventh time by then.
He retired before he worked for Bill.
Yeah.
In the early 90s.
Yes, at least once.
Yeah.
So I think that at that point, he was one of the best marketers in the world. And I think that my point is that it was his idea is that you should be spending your time focused externally on generating revenue for the business. And that's where, when you're not doing that, you will stall out. You will sort of fail to grow. So you have to be focused on that. And what one of the issues in that book is that, and certainly something that we've seen many times, is that as you move to different stages, there are periods where you have to focus internally and, you know, focus on like getting your ship straight, get everything right on the inside before you can actually have that next leg of growth. And so there are totally different challenges experienced at those different levels. And that book is a pretty good roadmap for making it through all of that.
Yeah, fantastic book. So Ready, Fire, Aim by Michael Masterson is where you want to start. So now we're going to switch gears a little bit, talk about success habits. And so we have a question from Karen or Karan. Hopefully I'm not butchering your name too badly. And he says, what does your perfect day look like, Matt?
It's perfect day I'll do it in the context of maximum productivity.
Sure.
So in that context for me, it's that I actually sleep until at least 4 a.m. That was the first start. I am at the gym by 5.
Do you spend a lot of time? Do you do the meditation before or just thinking before?
No, I'm just trying to actually get my brain to start moving probably before then. It depends. If I get up at 1:30 like I did yesterday morning, then yeah, I'm doing a lot.
Matt has sleeping problems. He's not trying to get up at 1:30.
No, I'm not. My goal is to sleep until 7 one day if I can. So anyway, from there, I like going to the gym. It makes a huge difference for me in my day. Deadlifted today, so it's been a good day so far.
Great.
I got up at 4:05.
Nice.
I was at the gym at 5.
Look at you. I got
my deadlift in. And then the next thing for me is about having my day mapped out. Specifically, you call it scripting. For me, it's nothing I do is as detailed as what he does. But I basically take from my electronic calendar, I write down all my appointments on one side of my notebook, and I kind of copy over the priorities or to-do items that might be left over from prior day onto there. And I just think about those a bit. And then I look at them, you know, if there's something that I shouldn't be doing or if I can do quickly with those, I might even do it right then. But then I go through and I start looking at the meetings and start preparing for whatever meetings I have that day, which most of my day is essentially dominated by my calendar. It has been for years. So if it's on my calendar, I show up prepared for it. If it's not on my calendar and it's a to-do item, then it's much harder for me to make happen. So I usually try and actually get my to-do items into scheduled events with other people as much as possible, because then I get more done. So to me, that's several successful productive meetings, I guess, is probably where when I come into the office. I usually, by the way, come into the office. If I have the kids that week, then I'll be in by 8:30. If I don't have the kids, then I'm like today, I'm in here by 7. Then from there, making sure that day I'm doing something that's meaningful in some way. If I'm coaching an employee and I feel like that we've made some sort of breakthrough, if I'm implementing some kind of a, if I'm working on developing a competency model to help transfer a knowledge-based skill, it's basically trying to define a soft skill in a hard way which allows you to train it and scale. So when I'm doing something like that, I feel there's a great sense of productivity, but I can sort of make the system better, you know? And then if I get to work on bigger ideas that are interesting and entertaining, like that's a lot of fun for me. So those things are big components of my day. I like to leave the office by 2:30, actually. I'm usually exhausted by then because I've been up since 1:30. and go home. And I do turn off in the evening. I mean, I might check my email a little bit in the evening, but for the most part, I turn it off. I like to read, so I'll spend time reading and maybe watching TV or something like that. Not TV with commercials, only Netflix or something like that. But yeah, I probably not the most productive in the evenings.
Yeah. So you see a big difference between Matt and myself, and Matt really articulated it well one day. He has there's a maker schedule and a manager schedule, and I'm on a maker schedule most of the time. And Matt is a manager schedule where he has to react to other people. He has to, have all these appointments, whereas mine, you know, there's big blocks of time for creative work. And so it is very different. And it's something that's difficult for a lot of entrepreneurs as they grow their business from a maker's company to a management company to have that overlapping. So what, any advice there?
Well, I think the biggest thing is to recognize that that is what the change that has to take place. The when people see it, the challenge for them is that they prefer the making.
Oh yeah.
I mean, they like it, and I get it. I mean, I like having that kind of time where I can just, it's all about me and my personal curiosities and interests. Like that's fun. Like that, I like it too. I don't blame people for not wanting to pursue that, but I still have that to a degree, but I have it way before anyone else is awake. Like that happens for me very early in the morning. But once the day starts and people come in, I have to have, like, I am there to make the organization flourish, and it's not about what my preferences are. So I have to be in a position where I can devote my time to inspecting the organization. And I don't mean like in a bad way, but like looking and making sure things are working right. Looking at the numbers in different ways. Sometimes it's listening to some sales calls that might be going on. Listening to recordings of them, just to see if there's something. Are we limited now by, our conversion rates from this step to this step? And if so, I want to know about it. And oftentimes I have to discover those things because other people aren't able to be able to pull themselves out to a different perspective to do it. So you have to have somebody in your leadership team, some manager of some kind, doing that kind of thing. And then beyond that, my time is spent trying to help the people and the system function more productively. So it's not about my productivity as much as it is the organization's productivity.
Yes. And Matt has actually created a course called Management Rhythms Blueprint, which takes you through how to become a great manager and implementing all these systems that he has used for years and years and years. So Matt, what are some of the habits of success that you would recommend to a high performer of any generation?
I think so beyond the things that I've mentioned already about making sure you're scripting your day, as he suggests, I think that that's so important to come into it with a plan. If you don't have an agenda, you're on somebody else's agenda. And that might be Facebook's selling you to advertisers agenda. It might be on, just like the
clickbait agenda.
Yeah. It could be that, people in the office and just getting pulled in lots of different directions. So if you don't have a plan, that you're in a goal and a direction you're trying to go, you will get sucked into someone else's. So it's so critical to have that, to make any kind of progress. I think beyond that, I really think it's going back to the stuff that I talked about with the spring break stuff. So I think that the most important habit someone should have is being able to alter their perspective, like seeking out ways to prove themselves wrong. So right after we created this management rhythms course, the next book I read was The Management Myth, which management myth is basically about how management is bullshit. Okay. Now the guy was talking about within a certain context, and he's mostly talking about consultants and stuff like that. But I want the ideas to be challenged. Like I'm interested in the truth. So I don't care. I don't own any idea. Like I'm not a disciple of anyone's school or anything like that. For me, I just want the truth. So I think it's been tremendously beneficial to me to be able to expose myself to different ways of thinking and to different approaches and to different people who are taking different approaches. And I think that if you can build that into what you do, and it's my own curiosity that drives me to do that. And if you don't have, and if you, I'm also, like, as we talked about, staying in touch with me is hard. So, like, being talking to people a lot is not something that's very taxing on me as an introvert. So I think that for a lot of it for me is done through reading. And then a lot of it is done then with small groups of people that I get to know really well, like with Atlas.
Right.
Okay. And the blacksmith camp mm-hmm. and things like that.
Okay, great, great. So we're running out of time here. So I actually want to tell you one story that I read about Obama of, and then have your perspective because this is about overcoming adversity. So I read this quote in this article about how Obama ran for Congress in 1999 and he said, "I got beat. I just got whooped. I had been in state legislator for a long time. I was in the minority party. I wasn't getting a lot done. I was away from my family. It was putting a lot of strain on that." And then he went and he lost really bad. And he was thinking, you know, "I'm 40 years old. Maybe this isn't for me." But then he said to himself, or he said, so he needed to remind himself that it was about the work, because he said, if you're worrying about yourself, if you're thinking, am I succeeding? Am I in the right position? Am I being appreciated? Then you're going to end up feeling frustrated and stuck. But if you can keep it about the work, you'll always have a path. And the last line, there's always something to be done. And so, you know, one of the stories that you told me was, you know, when there was, you know, when you were a kid and your mom, you know, she was working really hard for to take care of you and your brothers. And one day you guys went and got a pizza and the pizza was left on the roof of the car. And this happened to me and in my family about with some other thing on the roof of the car. But, you know, she saved up all week for this pizza. And then you went and bought the pizza. The pizza was left on the roof of the car. You went through an intersection and the pizza fell off and a car drove over it. And so, you know, it's just something like that. And when you or when you were in the army or when you were, you know, you had a tech company that went sour in 1999, you know, there's all these adversity things that come along. What do you tell yourself in those situations? As Obama said, there's always something to be done. What's your motto to get through those things?
Well, I think that failure is real, and extreme failure can hurt. I mean, probably the biggest failure for me that I can think of was that tech company in the dot-com boom. I raised millions of dollars and I lost everything I had and everything my investors had. And I was ashamed of myself for it. So I didn't raise money again at all until just recently, a tiny bit from people I know really well. And I will guarantee that they will get their money back if I pay it personally or whatever. So because I just, the shame from all that. So honestly, in that scenario, I spent 3 months sleeping on my mom's sofa. I mean, I had nothing at that point. And it took me a while to, like, you know, lick my wounds, I think, but that was an extreme failure. But I think, I don't know what else you can, there was also at the end of it, once I was a month or so into sleeping on my mom's sofa, there was like a little bit of freedom that came to it. Like, cause you know, sometimes you get on a track and you get very committed to success in that track. And then when it doesn't work out, you feel like, it definitely feels like it can be incredibly devastating. But the realization that I had at a certain point was that I was free of a bunch of things that I didn't like about that current situation. And yeah, I didn't have, I'd lost whatever money I had managed to save at that point. And I was really embarrassed by what happened. But I felt free in a big way too. And so so that kind of started to get me thinking differently. And after that, I ended up going to work for somebody who used to work for me. And it was, so to add to the humble pie of the whole thing, who's an awesome guy. And it was a pleasure to work for him anyway. And, you know, and I worked for him for a little over a year before I then started my own ad business. So I think the biggest problem that people have is when they haven't actually failed to an extent that's meaningful, they have a fear about it that really becomes crippling, because you feel like when something like that happens that there is no reasonable recovery from it. But I wanted to create that for Max on this trip. So I wanted him to fail. I wanted him to feel like that there was no easy way out of it. Mm-hmm. And then I wanted him to see that there was a way out. And then he got out, you know, but he had to fail. He had to, like, I was sleeping on my mom's sofa, I didn't have anything. And if I had no one to ask for help with, I just had to deal with it.
Right.
And realizing later, it really wasn't that big of a deal. I mean, not really. In fact, it was really important that it happened because it set the stage for all kinds of other things. So I guess my general approach is I just don't see, I mean, I don't see failure as a bad thing. I see failure as information. And I think that you have to be wise about it. There are certain, you need to protect yourself diligently from catastrophic failure. Like the, in which I should have protected myself from the catastrophic failure that occurred with that business.
But
hedged a bit, right? But the failure that most people are afraid of is not catastrophic. The failure that most people avoid is the failure that's enriching. It's the same type of failure that you get when you're weightlifting and you tear muscles, you know, you mess them up, which then allows them to get stronger. So if you're not willing to have that failure happen, if you're not willing to have that growth, that failure that must be there for growth to occur, then you're missing out on big opportunities, I think. And you'll never have a life that you'll be very happy with, that's for sure. So I think my perspective is that you definitely, at a certain point, you want to make sure you're doing something that you think is worthwhile in some way. And people will often say, describing that as, you know, following your passion. I don't really ascribe to that idea so much, but I do believe that you have to devote, you have to be doing something you find some meaning in. The work itself is meaningful to you. And that you should definitely, as I never thought I'd, I don't really refer to politicians of any kind, of any stripe, as saying things that are useful, but he is absolutely right in that when he says focusing on the work and just doing the work and not thinking about himself or feeling sorry for himself is the only way out. Mm-hmm. You know, there is no other way.
Right. And that leads us into so many other questions about the growth mindset and philosophy and all that sort of stuff that we just don't have time for today. But Matt, thank you very much for being on the Early to Rise Radio.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Awesome. So we will have him back on. And that wasn't so bad, was it?
It wasn't too bad.
There you go. So we did catch the elusive Matt Smith on camera. You can't keep him for long, though. And so we're going to let him get back to work. Thank you, everybody, for being on the show. And we will do more of these very soon. I promise you that. This is Craig Ballantyne from Early to Rise. Talk to you soon.